Moi ja tervetuloa Tahokansi-podcastiin. Tänään jakso tulee olla englanniksi. Mä oon täällä Rick Hardingkadun kirjastossa, täällä Kauhukonin tavallaan alakerrassa. Ja mulla on vieraana täällä, welcome Laura Mauro.
Hello, nice to be here.
Was that good pronunciation of the last name?
Yes, it's perfect, yeah.
Yeah. So Laura Mauro is a British horror writer and or author and her name sounds like it could be a Finnish name, so that's interesting. But welcome to Kauhukon, welcome to Finland. How is your day?
Wonderful. I love being back in Finland. Yeah, it's always nice to be back here. So as soon as I was invited to come to Kauhukon, I said, yes, of course I'll come.
Oh, yeah. So the reason why you are in Kauhukon now is probably because one of your books has been translated in Finnish.
Yes.
But you have also with literature, you have a connection in Finland and you like have a interests in Finnish folklore and stuff like that.
I do, yeah. I'm really lucky to have a Finnish friend, my friend Marit, who for years now has always, as soon as I said I was interested in Finnish mythology, she just sends me books and podcasts and anything on the subject that's translated into English, which is quite a bit. Mm. And I've always loved folklore anyway, but Finnish folklore in particular I really like because there's a, I think partly, firstly because there's a darkness to it. That I really love. I really love dark folklore, and I think also the other reason is because it's still quite alive. Mm. And I really like folklore that kind of lives to the modern day, and it's still in modern life a little bit. You know, folklore that hasn't died, it's still there.
Oh yeah.
Mm. And I really appreciate that about Finnish folklore. There's still little things like my friend's sister came to stay with me, and my cat was meowing at the attic and just meow meow. And she looked at the attic and said, "Ah, that's your house elf that he's talking to." Like very seriously.
Exactly. Yes.
So now, and oh yeah, that's the house elf. So I love things like that. My family are Irish originally, so we Irish people obviously have that same kind of thing as well. You know, that kind of the folklore is still very part of everyday life. So I think there's a little affinity there as well.
So you're like, your family has done the Samhain for us. Basically,
my nan, we used to joke that my nan was a witch.
Yeah.
So yeah. All that kind of thing. Yeah. And obviously, you know, it's where my family are from in Ireland, they were building a new road to join they live near Galway. And they stopped building the road because they were going to put the road for a fairy fort.
Oh, of course.
And of course, everybody in Ireland said, you can't do that.
Yeah.
It would be a cursed road. And this was, I think, 2010. Mm. So it's not a long time ago, but we must never build a road through the fairy fort. So yeah, it's
very interesting. Did you hear about the story in Finland about the Lemminkäinen and Lemminkäinen's temple?
No.
There was this person who is like a kind of a legend. He's already passed away, but he had this big kind of construction company. He talked them into digging out Lemminkäisen's. Like there was supposed to be in underground this temple of Lemminkäinen, which is from I think Kalevala or something like this. I'm not very good at folklore, but they really dug. They tried to dug it out for a lot of time. They didn't find it yet, but it's submerged in water.
Wow.
Well, that's what's like kind of because it kind of sounds like who would start the project like that unless there is some actual. In some, you know, unconscious way to believe that maybe it is there. Maybe it is, you know.
That'd be wonderful.
Yeah. How did you get into, like, folklore and how did you get into Finnish folklore originally?
Folklore, I think, has always been part of my life. I think even when you grow up in England, you know, English folklore is very present in a lot of our stories, particularly. So I think if you're particularly into horror, and I've been into horror since I was a small child. And I think folk horror now in England is having a big revival, but I think all English horror starts in folk stories, I think. So it's always kind of been there. And then, and this is very stereotypical, but as a child, I loved the Moomin books. Mm. Absolutely loved the Moomin books. And so, you know, growing up and kind of reading into that a little bit and, you know, the Finnish nature, and because they're very much about nature, right? I think it's just a combination of all of those things. It just kind of naturally drove me in the direction of folklore. And then I met my friend Marit and expressed, oh yeah, I have an interest in the Finnish folklore, and all of these books appeared. And and I just haven't looked back. I really loved everything that I read. Mm. Mm.
How about now? What would you say to a new person who hasn't yet known you or maybe heard your name like a first time? How would you kind of, if you wanted to do some kind of introduction to the listeners, who is Laura Mauro?
I think there's always an argument about whether I actually write horror or not, because my horror is quite quiet horror. And I think probably it fits more in weird fiction. So, you know, like Lovecraft and Ramsey Campbell and all of those writers. But yeah, I think I write quiet horror. I think it's probably the best way to describe what I write.
Quiet horror.
Quiet horror, yeah. I think it's not kind of horror that kind of takes you by the throat or jumps out at you or anything like that. But I think, I hope anyway, that it's horror that kind of lingers in your mind a little bit afterwards and makes you kind of think or feel. That's what I aim for anyway.
I apologize because I just said that you are a horror writer in the beginning because I didn't even ask.
Oh, I love being a horror writer. That's, you know, if anyone says you're a horror writer, I wear that
that's fine.
Very proudly.
Oh, that's good. Because that's kind of the angle that I've come to your work. So maybe the big subject is now today the On the Shoulders of Ottawa, which is your, it's like novella, which means in Finnish it's like between short story and, well, what's that, like novel.
Yes. Yeah.
But it's funny because in Finnish we use word novelli to say a short story.
Oh, okay.
So it's but anyway, it's a shorter book than usual.
Yeah, yeah.
But what it's about, what is, how would you describe On the Shoulders of Ottawa? So Ottawa is an olkapäällä, it's in Finnish.
Okay, I need to learn how to say that in Finnish. So I learned about, I don't even remember how I read about the Finnish Civil War. I think it was in maybe one of the books that I had read, and I found it quite interesting because I've been reading about other, I'm quite interested in war. And I was reading kind of about the Russo-Japanese War, which happened around about the same time. And it just kind of led me in that direction. And it really stood out to me that there was a women's unit, which is really, you know, in the history of war, in ancient history, yes, but in contemporary history, very rare to see women taking up arms. And so that was, I have to read about this. So that was my starting point, was, you know, I wanted to read about the Finnish Civil War and the history of it and why that happened. And then I kind of dug into the idea of the kind of the women's army a little bit more and why specifically it was on the side that it was on, you know, it was the red side, not the white side, and why that happened. And then it just felt kind of natural to bring folklore into it because, okay, what's the most horrific thing that can happen to you? I didn't want to tell a war story that was about the horror of war. I wanted to tell a war story that the horror was something else, was outside of war, you know. And then I thought, well, you were in the woods. And then I was at that same time reading the Kalevala. And I got to the chapter about the bear myths and how the bear came to be. And that just fascinated me. I love that. Yeah. I love the idea that the bear was created, you know, and brought down from the heavens in the, you know, the golden basket with the silver chains and all of that. It's a beautiful story.
Well, yeah. And I think I read the Finnish version and also started reading the English version, but I didn't finish it. So I like the way that the kind of Ottawa is used in there, and especially for me it was appealing about talking about the name of the bear, because in previous times you couldn't say it aloud.
That's so interesting to me. I was talking, I know it's the same in Russian as well, I think it's medved they say, and it means honey eater. And it's so interesting to me that, and it makes sense that the bear would be such a terrifying thing that you can't speak its name in case it appears.
Yeah.
So you give it a new name, because karhu, if I remember, is like coarse, isn't it? Coarse hair or So, oh no, we don't call it his real name. We call it, you know, a taboo kind of name.
Yeah.
That's so interesting to me. And it makes sense if you think, you know, I wouldn't want to go out into the forest and walk into a bear.
Yeah, because it's fast, it's strong, it's like a beast, but also it's very like, I don't know, your book made me think about it, the bear as like a god or like this.
Well, I got really into the ceremonies as well. So there's a... So this is a very kind of roundabout thing, but at the time I was reading a Japanese manga called Golden Kamui, and it's about Ainu culture. And there's a real similarity between Ainu bear worship and ancient Finnish bear worship, and it's very similar. Like the ceremonies they do are nearly the same, which I find fascinating. So reading about the ceremony and, you know, the idea that you send the bear back with, you know, all of this respect and this honor so that they will send more animals to earth. And I thought, that's amazing. That's, you know, you honor this powerful creature.
Yeah.
And you're terrified of, but you do it in this way that is so respectful of it that it can't help but, like, you know, I had such a good time on earth, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the way they, in the story that they talk about, that they apologize if they have to hunt it.
Yes, yeah.
And make it like, you give some kind of sacrifices so they don't get mad at you.
Which, you know, I guess with modern eyes, it's interesting because we're so cynical now, and I think you forget that attachment. And that's something that I really like about Finnish culture and Finnish kind of folklore, is that it is so attached to nature. Because I grew up in London, and, you know, in the city in London, and I've been lucky that my family are always quite attached to it, but it's easy to get detached.
Yeah, because there's a couple of parks. Well, and Hyde Park is big, but still.
That's it, though, yeah. Just a couple
concrete
of parks.
Concrete and, you know, subways and stuff.
The most nature we saw was seagulls and foxes and, you know, really skinny kind of sickly foxes. Yeah, not even healthy ones. So where I live now, I now live outside of Oxfordshire.
Ah.
Completely different. You know, it's semi-rural, so I'm nearly in the countryside. So, yeah, but I think keeping that attachment to nature and that and respect, but a fearful respect for nature.
Yeah,
because nature is powerful. It's more powerful than us.
Yeah, and we are like, I think this is very timely because if you think about now I'm losing the word, the natural kind of catastrophe, what we are kind of causing, or not kind of, but causing in Earth, in the bigger picture, and then you can see kind of Earth pushing back in a way.
Yeah.
Or you could think about it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think you could. I mean, in the UK, I was speaking to someone recently that, so we don't have any large predators in the UK.
Yeah.
I think the last lynx was killed thousands of years ago, and that was the last predator that we had. We did have bears at one point, we had wolves. And recently, there's been talk about reintroducing lynxes to Scotland, which I think is a great idea. But there's a lot of pushback because people are scared, because we haven't lived with those animals for thousands of years. And that's fascinating to me, that we're so detached from our natural kind of, you know, what should be around us.
Yeah.
But the idea of having any kind of predator nearby, oh no, we can't do that, that's scary. And yet everybody else in the world just lives with predators, it's just us.
But the fear is, I think, I don't know if it's universal, but also here, if you talk about, well, maybe your friend can tell more, but if you talk about Finnish way of being afraid of the wolf, that's very intense, very emotional discussion every year when there is like talking about hunting. And even if there's like just a couple of deaths in, you know, I don't know the details, but it's that's very emotional, very raw to fear. So I think it comes from a long way.
Yeah. It makes sense to be afraid of nature and respect it in that way. I can understand why, you know, I think it was in Italy recently, there was a bear that had killed a few people. And you know, of course they shot her and killed her. And because that's what we do, you know, when we're scared, we have that power to do that. So I think it's natural and right to have a fear of animals. It's just interesting that how we are so afraid of them that we won't even entertain the idea of having them. You know, we killed them all, and we could live side by side with them, but we don't want to try because we're so scared.
That's very interesting. But in the story, I think the fear of nature is kind of very evident. There is, I think, if you bit of talk about the story or the themes, like there's this group of women soldiers who kind of get lost in the woods, but they are trying to maybe, how do you say, like going around some military unit to maybe do some kind of attack, and then they kind of get lost, and then there is this something going on in the woods. So it's like you said, quiet horror in that sense that you don't really show that much that, okay, this is some scary stuff, but there is, you go into people's heads, they start to think about maybe old stories about this. In Finland, we call it liekkiä.
Yeah.
So if they see that, or, but it's interesting because the nature is maybe more fear, or they fear the nature more than the actual war. Or it's like, which one is more? But you talk about the machine gun in a very visceral way, like this machine gun, certain make of the machine gun, and what it does to a human body.
Yeah, I find that really interesting. It's, so I've always, my dad raised me with war films, and so I've always, and I guess because, you know, being British, war is in our very recent history, and it's very much in the British psyche. You know, we think about war all the time. We were always talking about the war, and I think watching from my generation, I think I've grown up watching war happen constantly, you know, in the Middle East, and, you know, and the idea that we do send people just to get shredded by guns is just incomprehensible to me. You know, I've always been a pacifist, and I know it's a privileged position to have. But it just, that particularly when you look at what those guns can do, and, you know, this is Maxim guns of the early 1900s.
Maxim,
yeah. What can technology do now? You know, things like the nuclear bomb and, you know, Hiroshima and all of that has always been really kind of morbidly interesting to me. Because I don't think there's anything worse that nature can do to humans than we can do to ourselves.
Yeah, if you think about it, that these guys who have built the Maxim in 100 years ago, so the same guys or the same scientists have been talking about more efficient ways of killing lots of people.
Isn't that an insane thought? How can what is the most efficient way we can kill the most number of people? Who thinks like that?
Yeah.
And we do. That's people, that's humans. We do that. Yeah. We're scared of the bear who's only hunting us to eat. And yet we're out here slaughtering each other. You know, it's very, I find it fascinating in a horrible way.
Yeah, it is. And in the story also, there's this, like I said, liekkiä. So it's old story about a child who has been killed by their parents or something like that, or some shameful way, that they would come back as this light being to kind of lure you into something.
Yeah.
How did you get, like, you have this Otava and the bear and then this liekkiä. How did you kind of collect the stuff that you want to talk about in the story?
The ghost light itself is a really interesting subject, because there's a ghost light in nearly every kind of mythology I've looked into has had some kind of ghost light. Ah. In the UK, we have the Will-O-The-Wisp. And in Japan, they have the Kitsunibi, which is the same kind of thing. So I don't know what it is about ghost lights, but we always see lights in the forest, right? And leading us kind of astray. And the liekkiä was really interesting to me, because at that time I was reading about a Japanese ghost called the Zashiki Warashi, which is a guest room child. It's the same thing. When a child is, you know, through, you know, the family can't feed the child. Yep. So quite often you would find that the youngest child, they would kill the child. And often that child would be buried under the floor.
Mm.
And so, but yeah, it's terrifying, isn't it? But the weird thing about the Zashiki Warashi is that it's actually considered, if you have one in your house, it's lucky. So, you know, if you move into a house and the guest room child causes mischief, people leave them sweets. Because it's considered good luck.
Oh, okay.
So whereas the liekkiä is something you don't want to run into in the forest. And a few years ago, I was in Sweden and in Gothenburg and walking through the forest there. And, you know, luckily didn't go too deep into it. But I did think, if I got lost in here, that'd be pretty terrifying.
Yes.
I would not know how to survive or get out. And so I think it was, again, like a combination of those things. Like, what could be the scariest thing that could happen to me? And it would be, you know, seeing something that I shouldn't be seeing.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, and like also in the story, this in the beginning, the women see a person who has seen something in the forest, and then something has kind of take a hold of him, and it causes him to go berserk or like crazy and violent towards his like friends. Mm-hmm. So that's also interesting, because I think there is lots of fear about, am I losing my mind?
Yes.
I'm in the forest doing something war stuff. Then there is this like mythological stuff, and there's also this tension in the story that is this kind of happening outside of the person's mind or inside or both.
Madness is a really interesting thing in horror. I've always really liked the horror where you don't really know what's going on, but you know it's scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like I don't think horror needs to explain everything to you, and in fact, I love horror best when it doesn't explain everything to you and you just know, okay, maybe it is a ghost light. Maybe that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe they're just afraid and lonely and cold and, you know, shell-shocked and all of those things. And they're just seeing things in these woods because they're lost. You know, either of those things could be true, but it doesn't really matter.
Yes.
What matters is what they're feeling, I think. And that's, even I don't know. Even I don't know what really happened in that story.
Yeah, I like that also. And I like it that it left kind of an uneasy feeling after reading it. And it still can go back to that. I think about how the forest would look like and would I go with the light or not. It's like, I think it put me in the shoes of those people. It's, ugh.
That's what I hope to do.
Yeah. But it's there's lots of like really big emotional impacts. There is this, they encounter a child in there. So I think for me, it does a lot of things that how sad it is to have a child wandering in the forest and thinking about what happened with their families and stuff like that. So there's a lot of sadness in the story.
Yeah,
there's fear and lots of sadness.
I think, I mean, again, you know, going back to the idea of war and these sort of the children left behind by war. And that was a big thing as well, you know, that when a parent is sent to war and a child has to become an adult.
Yeah.
You know, who looks after the house then? It's the children. You have to grow up and you have to... And it's interesting because, you know, the liekkiä obviously being, you know, is a child as well. So there was kind of a connection there. The idea that, you know, these children is being sent... Children are always the victims of everything, aren't they? You know, adults make these decisions and the children are the ones who suffer for it in the end. So, and they can't protect themselves. They can't fight back. They can't protest. And that's the biggest sadness, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, then they maybe try to ask for help. Maybe I try to talk some sense that please don't do this. Don't do this. Then they can see the adults doing the decisions. Yeah.
And they're powerless because no one listens to a child, exactly. Even if the child's right.
But that's in that in the story. That's those all those big emotions come, and it's very tight because it's kind of a short, very short story in a way. So, but very impactful.
That's good.
So it's good that we have it in Finnish also, so maybe more people can read.
I'm delighted by that.
Yeah, but how did this like Finnish connection to actually translating your story happen? Because how?
So I got an email from Tina Autola and a couple of years ago, was it a year ago now? And so Tina had been to Chillicom in the UK, which was, you know, a horror convention, and PS Publishing, who published the book in English, happened to be there. They had a stand.
Yeah.
And Marko Autola saw the book and thought that my name was Finnish, which is really funny.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I thought, oh, a Finnish book by, you know, by a Finnish author, and picked it up, and it's sort of, you know, the rest is history. But yeah, I think there's, I guess there's not very many books about, I mean, there's not a lot of Finnish books in translation either in English, which I find a real shame. Like when I was trying to find things about folklore or even just any horror, you know, we've got Johanna Sinisalo, and that's probably about it, to be honest, for Finnish authors in English. There might be a couple of others, but it's quite sparse. Mm. And information about Finnish mythology and legend and even history is also quite sparse. Mm. So, yeah, I was really, you know, when they contacted me and said, oh, you know, we were interested in translating this book into Finnish, that was an absolute joy, you know. I've always wanted to appear in translation. But because Finland and Finnish culture is so close to my heart, it was like, yeah, definitely. Well,
kind of like a coincidence in a way. Yeah.
It was meant to be.
So do you have your books translated in other languages?
No, I've had a short story published in Spanish. Okay. And which is The Pain Eater's Daughter, which was, and that's it. That's the only other thing I've had in translation.
Yeah. But English is a lot bigger language than Finnish. In a way, you have like your potential audience is very large.
That's true. Yeah. It's something that's very lucky about writing in English, you know. Although it's interesting because if you're a British writer, you have to kind of write in a certain way to crack America. An American market is, that's where the big publishers are and all the big awards. So I write very, if I'm not writing stories set in other countries, I'm writing very English stories a lot of the time, very British stories, which is fine. You know, I have no kind of real interest in, you know, being the next Stephen King or anything like that. I'd rather write what I find interesting.
Yeah.
But it's a privilege to be able to write in a, I guess, what is considered the global language. So.
How did the process go forward? You met with Haamu Kustannus, Marko Autola, Tina Autola by email, and what did you have some kind of? How does it work that you could give something kind of rights to? How did you choose that this book is going to be translated, and why that?
I think the lucky thing about being with a small publisher is there's a lot of autonomy. So I obviously said to PS Publishing, you know, this Haamu Kustannus are interested in translating this into Finnish. Is that okay? Yeah. And they said, yeah. I mean, they don't have, I think because it's a small publisher, there is no international rights. So it's kind of a, you can do what you want with it,
yes,
really.
That's nice.
Which is wonderful. Yeah. It's fantastic. So of course I said, it's all yours. If you want it, you can have it. Yeah. And then they contact me with Lauri Latu, who did the translation, who was just absolutely wonderful. Lauri asked me so many questions in the best possible way because he wanted to obviously make sure it was authentic, but also, you know, I really appreciated that if I did occasionally get a fact wrong or something, that he would correct it for me, because that's very important, you know. And luckily not too many. There was only a few of those, but Lowry has been absolutely wonderful, and I, you know, thank him so much for the hard work he's put in. He's been so thorough.
I'm kind of ashamed because we met him together in the upstairs just a moment ago, and I said it's very nice translation or something like, so it's like kind of putting it down, but it's excellent work. Mm-hmm. Yes,
he's done wonderful work. Yeah, I'm really pleased.
And it's interesting because this civil war is still like a, it's kind of a hot topic in Finland. Still, not like if you say about civil war blah blah blah, it's not you know, you don't get like attacks, but there is in certain undertones that are still alive from that time, which is kind of crazy. But it's also good that there's a like, you want to get the facts right in that case.
Yes, very important. Yeah, and there's not a lot of literature. There is a couple of really wonderful books, and some academic papers. And my friend Marit was very gracious and translated some papers for me as well. I was talking to Marco and Tina actually, and they said one of the interesting things about having the outside perspective is that you're not too close to either side.
Exactly.
And I didn't realize that. That hadn't occurred to me, that the objectivity would, you know, because you're not, I tried very hard to not necessarily sympathize with one side and tell a human story, not a kind of political story. But it didn't occur to me that maybe, you know, Finnish people would be too close to that to be able to do that. So that's really interesting for me to learn.
Yeah, I think if a Finnish author would write a story in that area, the first thing would be which side. But for you, it's not. And then reading it is very easy still. But it's kind of interesting that you have kind of a freedom to work with that material more than maybe us.
And obviously, you know, you want to be factual and get your facts right. That's very important, because the last thing I want to do is write about somebody else's history and culture and get it wrong. And, you know, again, you know, I've been very lucky with Mari, and also Lari has been, you know, made sure that I've got it correct, which is important. But, you know, I love researching. Mm. I love writing about things that require me to read. And the one thing that I learned really was that atrocity, and it, as it, always with war, atrocities happened on all sides.
Yes, yes.
You know,
yes.
nobody was an innocent party, and you can't be in war, can you? So that was one of the things I really learned, was, okay, I can't, even if I wanted to take a side, I can't.
It's all the same. And it's just, you can have the labels, but then the brutality is the same.
Exactly.
Yeah. How was this story... how did your readers respond in Britain or in the UK? And have you heard already from Finnish readers?
It flew a little bit under the radar in the UK, which I'd kind of expected, because it was quite a niche. It's a small publisher and it's a niche subject.
Oh,
but people who read it were generally very, very positive about it. And I think people who read my stuff know what to expect from me now in the UK, because I've kind of got that reputation of being, you know, the quiet horror, folklore. But people who read it actually in the UK were, most of them said, oh, I didn't know about this period of history. So that was quite nice actually, to kind of be able to say to people, you know, this is something to read about. This is something to research, because we in Britain, you know, we know about the wars that we participated in and we know about the wars that affected us, but we don't know an awful lot about, this is a very British thing. You know, we don't know anything about outside of our, you know, if it doesn't affect Britain, we don't know.
Yeah.
So it's nice to be able to kind of get people to maybe read about it and understand about it as well.
Yeah, that's good. It could be like the, maybe somebody, because there's events happening in big countries also at the same time that were huge, like revolutions and whatever. So
yeah, loads of revolutions at that time.
Have you heard from Finnish readers yet?
Yeah, so there've been a few reviews so far, and I mean, I've been blown away by it. Everybody's said some really wonderful things about it so far, and I hope that it continues. But I mean, I think it's a big worry when you're writing about someone else's culture, that you want to be respectful and correct, and, you know, not run over, you know, make things up too much. And so far people have responded really positively to it, which makes me, you know, very, very happy.
Yeah, but I think the thing about this story is that there is details and there is like... historical accuracies and stuff like that, but in a way it's a story that could happen in anywhere, because there's people are alone, they're like scared, they're in the forest and they are in the war, and terrible things kind of start happening or taking their minds, so that's kind of universal.
I think that's something horror does really well, more than any other genre actually, is that it is stuff that can happen to anybody anywhere. You know, and you'd say anyone could get lost in the woods. Anyone can experience war. And I think writers are sometimes afraid to step into the shoes of people that aren't exactly like us. And we shouldn't be, because you're still writing about people.
Yeah.
You're still writing about humans. We're all human, you know, as long as, you know, you do your research about, you know, if you're going to say it in another country or another culture, do your research, obviously, like you would anyway. But you're writing about people ultimately. And, you know, everyone experiences fear and you know, loneliness and all of that. So
And I think that a big one was that fear of losing your sanity in that story. It was so big. And then when one of their friends, maybe there is spoilers in this discussion, but I don't think it ruins the experience. But for example, there was this moment in when I was reading the story, one person decides to go check things out by herself, And that was like, well, first of all, I was like, no, don't do it. but this leads to also you fear from further your friend.
Yes.
And,
yeah.
And if they get something happening to them, will they go crazy? Will they ever come back? All that stuff. So a lot of people can relate.
She's the character who did that. She's kind of takes a leadership role.
Yeah.
And I think if you've ever had to be the kind of friend who takes charge, you feel that responsibility, don't you? You feel like, oh, okay, you know, I have to keep these people safe, so I have to be the one to go and check it out. So, you know, and then she gets lost and she's gone. And what do we do without her? Now we have no one in charge now, you know? Yeah. So it's kind of, you know, a double thing, like the responsibility of being the person who has to keep everyone safe and what happens when they're gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, and what happens if you find her and she's not who she is?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a horrible thing. You know, I think we all fear things like dementia and Alzheimer's and all of those kinds of things, that when you watch people lose themselves is an awful, awful thing to watch.
Yeah.
And yeah, to have that happen to you by some kind of, you know, terrible power or something, and you find someone and suddenly they're not who they were. That's a horrible, I don't like thinking about that.
Yeah. I understand. I have a relative who has this memory disease going on now. How do you say? My English is kind of, it's okay, but I'm losing the words. But relating to a person. So when I was reading this, at first, okay, the kind of setting is that this woman company or small group of soldiers. But after a while, I kind of forget the gender.
Mm-hmm.
I just think about how it feels to go there. So that's interesting in horror also. But why was this a novella? What made the kind of was it a decision, or was it something that the story just was like longer than a short story?
So when PS Publishing approached me, they asked me specifically for a novella, and I could have written a longer one. Novellas, it's a funny category in the UK, or any, you know, it, what people define as novella is really vague.
Yeah.
It's so vague. So I think it's about 21,000 words, and I could have written more, but I got to a point where I thought, actually, if I write any more, it'll explain too much.
Yeah.
And that's really not what I wanted to do. I wanted to leave it at a place where the reader could make up their own mind about it a little bit and say, okay, this is where I think it should go. Or this is, you know. Yeah. And it's really important to me. I remember someone saying to me once that I never end my stories properly. That all my stories end really vaguely. And that's, I did it on purpose because I think in a novel, you have to wrap everything up, right? You have to, everything has to be neat.
Yeah.
When you write a novel, you can't really get away with leaving things undone. But I think short stories and novellas have that kind of magic. You can kind of leave it up to people, and the atmosphere and the details are kind of for them to kind of decipher. And I that's how I like to read those stories, so I like to write those stories also.
How is your writing? Does it, because I know that previously you have published short stories or collections. Was this the first of the longer format?
I'd written a novella before years ago, and that was a very British novella. Okay. It's called Naming the Bones, and that was a very small British publisher. And that's about like the London Underground and things like that. But so I think this is the second, doing it the second time round was a lot better because I'd already tried it once. So yeah, I think I had the practice the first time, and I feel like I managed to get the form, I think, do the form better this time.
How is your, like, do you work with the kind of whole story? Do you have it ahead of you, some kind of planned, or do you go like by instinct and just start doing, and then how do you work?
I'm very much an instinct writer. I never plan anything, because if I plan it, my brain says that I've already written it and it doesn't want to write it anymore.
Oh, yeah. This is done. Okay, let's next one.
Yeah. Honestly, if I, okay, this and this, and my brain says, well, you've written the story now, so let's do something else. So I always have images or maybe a scene or one or two scenes that I know I'm going to write. And then the rest of it is kind of, okay, like it's like looking at a map and going, okay, A, B and C, but how I get there, I don't know. We'll find out.
What were the first, do you remember what was the first or first couple of things that came to you from this story?
I knew that I wanted to write about bears because that was really in my mind at the time. And I wasn't sure how I was going to write work bears in, because I had, you know, the Civil War and I had bears.
Yes.
Right. How am I going to put these together? Yeah. Then? actually, I was reading in one of the books I read about the Civil War, there was a girl, they were kind of accounts of, you know, firsthand interviews with women who'd fought. And one of them was a woman called Esther.
Okay.
And I thought, right, Esther is going to be in the story. And I didn't know where she was. So I had those three elements. I had, yeah, the war, bears, and this girl called Esther. Okay. And she was very, like, fierce when I read about this girl. And she was, you know, she's a real person, obviously. And she had no fear and no, she knew she was doing the right thing from her point of view. And I thought I would be really interesting to write about somebody who is that certain of themselves. Yeah. And then what can make them uncertain? Because it's not going to be her convictions that make her uncertain.
Yeah.
So something has to happen to make that change. And that was kind of where it came from.
Yeah. Mm. Do you see, like if you describe those, do you see them as kind of a visual things, or is it more like words in your head or ideas?
When I'm writing it, I see it. Mm. It's like there's a film in my head that I'm, and I'm just describing the film a lot of the time. Yeah, yeah. And I'm really lucky. I think the reason that I write so descriptive is because I can see it in my head and I'm just like transcribing what's going on. like watching a film. Yeah, yeah. I'm a very visual writer, yeah. Mm.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, because when I read it, this story, I could imagine, for example, this verse very visual in my head, the one when the person went kind of crazy in the kind of beginning in the, I don't know which area they were, but I could kind of visualize the raggy clothes and the anything about the scene, so that would make a great movie.
maybe we'll see.
Yeah. I wanted to discuss also a couple of your other short stories, if that's okay.
Yep, that's fine.
I've been reading this the collection, and the first one I read was Sun Dogs. So there is a nature element also there.
Yeah, I really, as I say, nature and the power of nature is something that really interests me. And Sun Dogs, that again, you know, funnily enough, that was I wanted to write about the desert.
Yeah.
Because the desert scares me, like more than a forest does.
yeah, because there's nothing to eat, right?
There's nothing.
No water.
I don't like the sun. I don't like the heat. Yeah. So, you know, a forest, I could be all right. I manage. I'll be all right in a forest. A desert, no. I would die within half a day. I'll be gone. So yeah. And then it was kind of like, I do this thing sometimes where I go on Google Maps and I drop in an area and I walk around on Google Maps.
Ah, the street view stuff.
Yeah, on street view. And I did that in the desert and I was just looking. There was nothing. There was just miles and miles of nothing at all. And I thought, that is the most terrifying place on earth to me.
Yeah.
And then I read that there were people who, in America, who deliberately live in the desert because they sometimes because they just want to be away from people. Mm. And sometimes it's because they have this kind of fear of the apocalypse or the end of the world.
Oh.
And so they kind of like build a fort, a little fortress in the desert. And I thought, that's insane.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, but it's kind of for me, it was a story about there was, if you talk about folklore, you could read it as, this is something to do with werewolf style stuff.
Yeah.
But it's not exactly that.
Yeah, it was about, I mean, werewolves was definitely in my head at the time, but coyotes are really interesting animals. Oh. Yeah, they're, in a lot of native tradition, coyotes, they're tricksters. A bit like how foxes are in kind of like in Europe. And I don't know, I just find them fascinating. I think they're really interesting because they're you talk to Americans, coyotes, they're, you know, they go through your bins and they make a mess. Mm. And I think they're quite majestic. I think they're, because I don't have to live near them.
Yeah, they can survive in the desert, right?
Yeah, well, this is, they can survive.
How do they do it?
They can survive anywhere. Yeah. And that to me is, you know, the mark of an incredible animal. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, what if instead of wolves, it's coyotes? What if, you know, because they're shapeshifters a lot of the time as well. And I thought, okay, we've got shapeshifting in the desert and, you know, tricksters, but does a trickster always have to be a bad thing or a bad person?
Yes, exactly. Mm. You know, there's this, is it ambiguity, the term, that is like, this is not good or bad, and this is just a, maybe it's a coyote actually who is keeps somehow transferring the person and not the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
Usually it's always like people and then they just in the moonlight they are growing the wolf stuff, but maybe you can think about this different way. But there is this, like, in also in the sort of Ottawa thing, there's like, who is good, who is bad? It's not that very clear.
It's really, it's really important to me that I think a lot of stories want there to be good and bad, and people just aren't built that way.
No.
That's just not how people are, and it's something that I really want to deal with in stories a lot of the time, and I try really hard for there not to be a clear-cut bad person or good person, because, yeah, that's just not, and horror does it a lot, obviously, because the horror genre is you have to have a villain. And I've always said that it's really important for me, if one thing comes out of my stories, I want people to have sympathy for the monster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I always feel like a monster doesn't choose to be a monster most of the time. Monster is what we make. We make monsters, yeah. right? You know, we because we think something's frightening or disgusting, or so we make monsters. And no one gets to choose to be a monster. So for me, I thought it was really interesting to look at, okay, I guess maybe I read Frankenstein when I was really young, and you know, obviously you do sympathize with the monster in that, because he never chose to be the monster. It wasn't his choice.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the same with all monsters, I think.
Yeah. And it's interesting what, for example, what animals we kind of label as bad animals and good animals. That's a bigger discussion, but you know, like snake from the Bible and stuff like that. So they get this kind of stamp, and this is a bad animal.
So when I was younger, this is my nan. She's I was so fox hunting is a big thing in the UK.
Oh yeah,
well, not so much anymore, but and it's I've never, you know, I disagree with it. I don't agree with it at all, because it's not necessary. It's a sport. And so you grow up with this idea that the fox is, oh, no, they're killing all of our chickens and they're predators. We don't have any predators in the UK either. The fox is all we've got. So we're still trying to kill that predator. And like, yeah, I think I grew up thinking it was a real injustice that we get to say that animal's a bad animal, so we're going to hunt for it. We're going to kill it. We're going to get rid of it. It's not even like we eat it or use it we're killing it because we can.
Yeah.
And, you know, so for a very young age, you know, my nan used to take me on the protests and the marches against fox hunting and all of that sort of thing. So I've always had a sense of like, I don't, you know, who gets to say who is evil?
Yeah.
Who gets to, you know, we've got this privilege that we can go, that we don't like that animal needs to die. And, you know, we've done it in Britain, you know, all of our predators are gone because we made that decision. And I think that's a real shame.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's something that, well, horror is good for thinking about those things, because I think in real life, lots of things happen that there's, for example, there's some tragedy going on, and that is then this discussion starts. Who is to blame? And then we try to kind of take a clear-cut, basic example of what were the reasons for this stuff. But and usually the reality is very complex, and you know, anybody could be the monster. So it's, I don't know, it's some kind of defense.
It makes us feel better, doesn't it? I think if we can point a finger, and sometimes you can, you know, there are situations where someone, you know, but I think more often than not, you can't, but we need to.
Yeah.
We have to feel safe. We have to be able to say, okay, all the bad people are over there and all the good people are over here. And as long as the bad people stay over there, we'll be okay. Yeah. And it doesn't work that way, but we feel safe doing that.
Yeah, something like that. I can now think about something else. This is solved, so let's go.
Exactly, yeah. And I understand why human nature works that way, but I think, you know, also it does us no good at all to think of it that way.
But I think that's one of the reasons I like horror. I think that it lets you be in the situation that, you know, you have to kind of stay in that mood that this is, anybody could do this. How does it feel to be the monster, for example, if you go?
Yeah, it really interests me. I think and it's one of those things that I think if you spend a lot of time in school or any kind of environment where there's a social environment, you find that, you know, people, you know, when kids get bullied and things like that, you know, we start making monsters really young.
Yeah.
And even when you get, like, you know, kids who are weird kids, or if you grow up, like I grew up on a housing estate and you had people that were weird people, you know, there's nothing, they did nothing wrong.
Yeah.
They were not, they maybe one of them was quite poor and her house was shabby, or one of them didn't talk very much. But even on that really benign level, we make monsters. And then you grow up and then you kind of go out into the world and you see the way that we make monsters to keep the blame from ourselves and to keep the blame. I know it's human nature to do that, but I think we should question it.
Yeah.
And I hope that, you know, through fiction is a good place to do that.
But I think this story, Sundogs, is kind of, it's a lot of things, but it's exploring that. Because there are people who they say that, okay, they're looking for this person, the shapeshifter, and that's bad, but is it? And there is a love story in a way, or a friendship story. Yeah, it's complex.
It's complex, yeah.
But it's good.
You know, I guess my idea for that was, you know, okay, if these coyotes are killing children, you know, I think it was around that time that there was something, maybe wolves killing children in Europe, and, you know, you hear those stories a lot as well. And our instinct, like I said with the bear earlier, is that if it kills a child, then we have to kill the bear.
Yeah.
And then you think, well, you know, I understand that instinct, but all the bear's doing is trying to survive. And it's harder for the bear to survive because of the world that we've put the bear into.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So yeah, same with the coyotes. We make a difficult world for animals to live in.
Yeah.
And then we blame the animals when they try to survive. And yeah.
It reminds me of the gorilla. Was it Harambe or something?
Yes.
Was in the zoo that some person that goes there, does something stupid, and then what we do is kill the gorilla.
As if it's the gorilla's fault that someone went into. And the gorilla's already not living in the wild. The gorilla's already in a box that we put.
Yeah, it's in a jail, basically.
Yeah. It's crazy. It's crazy. Mm. Yeah.
And one more story. This is like, there's a lot of big themes in all of these stories, and you could spend hours of talking, but I just read on the train, or finished on my way here in Helsinki, there was this story, The Pain Eater's Daughter. So, devastating story about, I think, sadness and dying and, you know, feeling pain and trying to take the pain away from your loved ones if you can. And that's totally different mood, or not totally different, but how could you make the pain go away?
Mm.
What was that? How does it that story came?
So when I was writing my short story collection, I wanted to write a couple of new stories for it, and that was one of them. And my grandfather was—he has cancer, and he was terminally ill at that time. And obviously, you know, watching a loved one waste away is a horrendous thing. And I kind of thought about the idea of pain and suffering, and the idea that what if you could take it away, and you could transfer it, and you could, you know, take someone's suffering away like that. But then it kind of occurred to me that it has to go somewhere.
Yeah.
Like, pain isn't, you know, something as kind of profound as pain or sadness has to, it can't just disappear into the air. You know, you'd love if you could just take someone's sadness and throw it away and it gets scattered to the wind.
That's,
you know.
Yeah.
But it can't, you know, it has to go somewhere. So I kind of had this idea that it gets, you know, bottled up. literally bottled up in a jar and kept in this kind of, you know, toxic environment where, but then, you know, does it take a toll on you to do that?
Yeah.
You know, to literally physically remove pain from somebody. So it was kind of this process of, okay, if you could do this, but then what would happen? What would the consequences of it be? It was an interesting story, and it was, you know, writing it at that time, and with the kind of, you know, the story, the character in the story is a Romani gypsy, and I'm from, you know, my background is some of my family are Romani gypsies as well, so there's that element of it as well. And it's always what we would consider the dirty people who do the dirty jobs, which is interesting. In Japan, they've got a thing called Barakamin, and they are a kind of like a caste of people.
Yeah.
And their families used to work in slaughterhouses. And to this day, if you are from a Barakamin family, you are looked down upon because you've got that history of doing this undesirable job. So there's all of these things kind of converging, like this most, it's an undesirable job, but someone has to do it.
Yeah.
So, and you know, is it fair that somebody has to be, you know, perceived as dirty and unclean because they're doing something so important? Yeah, a lot of thoughts. Lots of thoughts.
And there is this dad figure in the story that his job is to go to people's houses and do a certain process to get the pain to a jar, and then the jars must be taken to. But it's kind of a how do you describe the job? It's like, okay, you have to go to the job and take the car and take some nights away. So it's like a salesman.
That's exactly what I thought.
The feeling was in the first, and then when you realize in the story what is he doing, or the daughter realizes what is he doing and why, because they have some kind of gift that they can do it, so they kind of think that they have to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's not taxing, it's like doing something for you also.
Yeah. The idea that you have to is something that's really interesting to me as well. You know, like if you, I thought about it, you know, if I could do that, would I do it? Well, of course.
Mm.
Of course you would do it. You know, for me, it's not a choice. You know, if one, it's the greater good, isn't it? One person suffers so that 100 people don't have to. And it's a kind of a classic argument in philosophy, you know, what's the, you know, utilitarianism and all that, you know, if one person suffers so that 100 can be free, is that right? And it was just sort of like, you know, if that is your calling, if you've got that unique ability to go to someone and see their suffering and take it away.
Yeah.
To me, that would be, that's no question. Of course I would do it. But I talked to other people and other people said, well, no, I wouldn't do that, you know. So it was just interesting to get that perspective. And I don't think they're wrong either. I don't think anybody's wrong for saying, no, I wouldn't do that. Mm. If it means I have to suffer for it, no.
Yeah.
I don't think that's wrong at all. I think fear of pain and suffering is completely normal and natural. Mm. And I don't think it's selfish to want to avoid it. Then the idea that this girl kind of sees the toll it takes and still chooses to do it anyway. Yeah. You know, she sees it twice, you know, with her grandfather and her father. And then she says, well, you know, what else can I do?
Mm.
You know, especially for the people who came before you.
Exactly. Yeah. And how could you stop if you realize that, okay, I can make this better for this person in this case? Then, of course, there will be other people. Yeah. So how would you draw the line?
This exactly.
I'm going to stop now. So why? Because the pain is coming.
Yeah.
But it's a very deep story. And I wouldn't say, like, if you had to be, I don't like genres in that, like putting labels.
Mm-hmm.
But if I would put labels here, it would be hard to put a horror label in this story. It's like it's a story about pain and, you know, sorrow maybe.
Yeah, I think that's fair. A lot of my stories kind of don't fit neatly. And I say I'm always proud to be a horror writer.
Yeah, of course.
But I also completely understand that a lot of my stories aren't, you know, horror in capital letters, which is fine, you know. And I think what people find horrific varies so much as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, in that story there is, of course, kind of horrific elements, or maybe that so deep emotional trauma that it's like, oh no.
I wrote a scene in that about a deer. The reason I put the deer in it was because for some reason, horror, there's always a deer in horror. I don't know what it is about deer, but like, you know, whenever you want a weird animal, you know, like you go into the woods and something's weird, it's always a weird deer.
That's true.
And I don't know why that is. And I thought, I want a weird deer in this story. So the deer isn't weird, actually. The deer's just dead. But, you know, I just thought, you know, I think a deer is a good mark of horror story. So sometimes I just put things in because of that. You know, it's not a deep reason to put a deer in it.
It's funny because I just read a great Finnish book, but there's a deer is a very central role there. And it's kind of a... I will talk to you later about the story, but I don't know if it's translated, but if it would be, I would recommend it.
That sounds like it'd be up my street.
Yeah.
But
I guess if you could or I could just be violent and just have comparisons of these stories, or what are the, if there's some like common elements, well, there's this deep, like not being in certain genre specifically, and then there's a viewpoint of a child or something that is like not could like how do you say defend themselves. There is children, or there's something that is vulnerable in all of these, and then like this ambiguity about good and evil, and also nothing is basically solved. Things are going on.
Yeah.
How do you feel about this?
Yeah, I think, and none of this is deliberate. It's really interesting when people say to me, "Oh, you know, I've seen these patterns in your stories," and I love that actually, because I say things like, you know, oh, you know, I write about sympathy for the monster, but those are only things I've learned like looking back.
I
set out to write things, I've never go, okay, this is going to be about this. It's always I have an idea and then I want to write about that idea, and whatever comes from that comes from it, but it always seems to be the same things. So obviously there's something in me that finds those things
interesting.
But I think horror or weird fiction or however you want to define them is something that doesn't end, and that's why I don't end my stories a lot of the time, because it doesn't, nothing is that neatly tied up.
Yes.
I don't believe in that, so I don't want to tie my stories up neatly either.
what is in your future as a writer? What do you see now?
Well, I mean, I've been writing video games for the past 3 years. I work for a company called Bonsai Collective, and we're releasing our first game hopefully this year. So I haven't had as much time. And I was doing a PhD for a little while, but I had to quit that because it was just too much work. And that was going to be about Japanese ghosts and mythology. Oh, so there's a whole theme. but I actually just wrote another short story a few weeks ago, which, you know, I've sent off a submission, so we'll see what happens with that. So I feel like, I think time is good to start writing stories again. I've missed it a lot, actually. When I was doing my PhD, I just did not have the energy to write.
Oh, of course, yeah.
It was constant. So now I've kind of had a little bit of recovery time. I think now it's time to come back into it. I've got more stories to tell.
Nice. Yeah. Do you have some way of gaining inspiration from other art forms? Do you like read a lot of books or watch movies or whatever? What do you do?
I read lots of books, visual art and music, actually. I get lots of inspiration from visual art and music, and I think more than books. Books will always inspire me. But also, if it's books, it's usually nonfiction that I'm inspired by. Like things like folklore or, you know, mythology or collected tales or history or things like that. Or, yeah, I think that's mostly what inspires me more than fiction. Or if I see a painting or listen to a piece of music.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm really inspired by that. I was down at the Natural History Museum earlier today.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was standing by a massive elk. And there was a huge taxidermy owl next to it. And I looked at that and I thought, I think there might be a story in that somewhere as well. So we'll see. But yeah, just looking at things. The world is inspiration.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have some recommendation from me? Like if you had to think about a book or music or something, a movie you could recommend to me now?
Oh, okay. So for a book, I would say anything by Priya Sharma. She's a British author. She writes similar sort of thing, novellas and short stories. And she's got a wonderful collection called All the Fabulous Beasts.
All the Fabulous Beasts.
Yes. And I think a similar kind of thing. She writes on the cusp of horror and fantasy and things like that.
It's a... thank you.
The third person.
Yeah, that was a ghost of the library saying that they're going to be closing the library in 15 minutes, so it's fine. Okay, but All the Fabulous Beasts.
That's by Priya Sharma. Music, Sigur Rós. I don't know if you know Sigur Rós.
From Iceland?
From Iceland.
Yeah, I know.
They're one of the most inspiring bands whenever I listen to them, because there are lyrics to it, but sometimes the lyrics are in a made-up language.
Mm.
And sometimes it's in Icelandic, which I don't understand anyway. But it's more like soundscapes.
Yeah.
So whenever I listen to them, when I was writing On the Shoulders of Batava, actually I had a lot of Sigur Rós on because of the, they're just big.
Yes.
Big sounds, big, it feels open somehow. So yeah. I don't watch a lot of films. I'm trying to think of a really good film I've seen recently. No, I've gone blank on films, sorry.
Okay, that's fine. I have one recommendation on films for you, but I will give it after stop recording. Thanks a lot for this discussion.
No, thank you for having me.
Yeah. Do you have some, do you want to say some final words for people who listen still?
Yeah, well, thank you for listening. And I hope that you understood my accent, because I know it's a bit strange. And thank you for, you know, I just really appreciate the reception that this book has had, and, you know, all the hard work from everyone at Hammarkustannus and Laurie and yourself, obviously. It's just a real joy to, you know, to be able to bring my stories to a new audience. So, yeah, I appreciate that.
Okay, thank you. And tomorrow is Sunday. I don't know when this will be released, but anyway, you are here at Kauhukon. Marko Hautala will be interviewing you, right?
Yes, that's right. So, yeah.
I give all of my best for you in the future projects, and hope to read more of your stuff.
Thank you very
much. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for listening. We'll see you again.